James 5:20. It says, let him know that he which converteth the sinner from the error of his way shall save a soul from death, and shall hide a multitude of sins. That verse is commonly used to refer to soul winning, but that verse primarily refers to the restoration of a brother that's in sin. The verse before makes that clear. Brethren, if any of you do err from the truth, and one convert him, let him know that he which converteth the sinner from the error of his way shall save a soul from death, and shall hide a multitude of sins. The principle is the same, whether referring to a lost man or to a saved man. Conversion is something that takes place when a person turns around in his way of life and turns to another way of life. Conversion generally refers to a person turning from sin to the Lord. There is an aspect of salvation which we call conversion. It's also possible for a Christian to be converted again, not saved again, but turned around away from his sin again, repenting and getting right with God and so on. But there are some other verses. The one that comes most notably to mind, of course, is Proverbs 11:30. It says, the fruit of the righteous is a tree of life, but he that winneth souls is wise. In other words, the highest degree of wisdom is a person who wins souls, a person who is a soul winner. Now, what does it mean to be a soul winner? That's a Bible term. Many people say, well, you know, I want to be a soul winner, so what do I need to do? I need to go on visitation. You know, you can go on visitation for a long, long time and never be a soul winner. You can be a soul winner and never go on visitation. If you, however, have what it takes to be a soul winner, you probably will be on visitation, okay? Because coming on visitation is one of the best ways to get with other people who want to learn. Also the best way to make sure that everybody that has visited our church hears the gospel in a one-on-one contact. So that's the best way to get started. Plus, if there's not a regularly scheduled time, it's very difficult. Last Thursday night, I met with the folks who came out on visitation. I was going to meet with you again tomorrow night. I'm not going to be here. I've taken an opportunity. I'm taking a ministry of my own on Thursday nights. I've been praying that God would give me an opportunity to come into contact with some lost men and lost people, and this would be a way that I could share the gospel with them. I have plenty of preaching opportunities. As you probably know, I preach here several times each week, and then I preach on the radio every day, and I have all the opportunities that I need to preach. But I want to be with some lost people, some people who don't hear the gospel all the time, and some people who have never heard that Jesus died for them, or if they've heard it, they think they know what it means, but they probably don't. And so the Lord's opened an opportunity for me to have a ministry with some men on Thursday nights. And so I'm going to be taking advantage of that opportunity. And in fact, as a result of this, in association with this same group, there is a thing for teenagers that meets on another night during the week. Then maybe once a month I'll be able to get to be with them. And so you pray with me about that as I get involved in that particular thing, and I'll give you a little bit more information about it later on. But it's going to be a real exciting opportunity, and I'm thankful for it. So I won't be meeting with the folks who come on visitation tomorrow night, but I am going to go ahead and finish that soul-winning course, and it'll be on tape, and there will be a pace that goes with it where you'll be able to study the course and go through it and learn how to become a soul-winner, how to get the burden. And again, I think much of the emphasis needs to be on why and not just totally on how. Because if a person can understand why they're supposed to do a thing, a lot of times they'll be very creative to learn how. When I was just a boy, I must have been 9, maybe 10 years old. I had an experience with me, maybe the one that gave this experience to someone else. My brother and I was with some friends of ours, and they had a pond. And they decided they were going to throw me in the pond. And I couldn't swim. But I managed to survive somehow after they threw me in. I wasn't very graceful, and I didn't set any records, but I did get out of the pond. Now, the reason I did was not because I knew how, but because I knew why I needed to. You see, if you know why you need to do a thing, you'll often be very creative in discovering ways in order to do that. Have you ever, when you were first saved, you were much more zealous, many of you, much more zealous witness when you were first saved than you are now. And you know much more about the Bible and about soul winning than you knew then. But you had excitement and zeal. Why? Because you knew why. You weren't that far removed from the heat of hell itself, yourself, and you realized that people needed to be saved. So I think sometimes we forget why. Now, I mentioned this book And some of these thoughts are from this book that I was talking about on Sunday, The Soul Winner by Charles Spurgeon. And we're going to talk probably on a Wednesday night here sometime in the future about what is soul winning. But I want to talk to you tonight for a few minutes about what is a soul winner. Well, first, what is a soul winner in his relationship to God? And then if we have time, we'll look at what is a soul winner in his relationship to man. The first thing a soul winner is, I suppose we should say what he is not. He is not merely a man with a plan. He's not just a man with a plan. He is a man with power. A man with power from heaven. In other words, he is God's representative. Just because a person has a plan does not make him a soul winner. I remember when I was in the service, there were a lot of fellows that were involved in a sales organization that offered security and extra money and things like this. And a lot of times, these fellows would have bumper stickers on their cars that would say, "Have you seen the plan?" Well, I wondered if this wasn't from some church. And so I asked this guy one day, "What plan are you talking about?" Well, I had to listen to his plan. And then I said, "Well, have you seen my plan or the plan that I tell folks about?" "No, what's your plan?" I said, "Okay, now I heard your plan. You listen to my plan." And so the fellow sat down right next to my desk and I gave him the plan of salvation. So that's the plan I like to share. I'm not interested in anybody else's plan, get rich quick plan or whatever it is. But it's more than just a plan. Have you ever thought about the fact, and you men can identify with this, and probably you ladies can too, you have certain tools that you really enjoy working with. I have three hammers. And one of my hammers I use when I just want to influence something strongly. I mean, I really want to hit it hard, you know, and I'm not really particularly interested in doing fine work because I've had that hammer for a long, long time. There's a real interesting story behind how I got that hammer. My wife will have to share that with you sometime. She was going to buy that for me for my birthday one year. Father's Day, wasn't it? About 1969 or 70, somewhere around in there. And we didn't have a car then. All we had was a motorcycle. I had a motorcycle. And, oh boy. And so she wasn't going to ride the motorcycle. So she took off to walk to the base where I was stationed. To go to the base exchange to get a hammer, and she started walking in the wrong direction. But anyway, that's all I'll tell you about it. But long, long walk. Well, anyway, I got that hammer. I've had it a lot of years, and it's all beat up and everything. Handle's coming off of it. Then I have another hammer that I found that I thought I knew who it belonged to, and I took it to him, and it wasn't his, so I've gotten it somehow. It's got a wooden handle. It's broken. Then I've got my new hammer, my Craftsman hammer. That's the one I drive nails with. The other things, I hit things and break things and drive chisels, have special purposes for each of these hammers. And then I have a whole lot of screwdrivers. I have probably 25 or 30 screwdrivers, I guess. Some of them have good points and some of them have really bad points. Some of them I don't use like screwdrivers at all. I use them for other things, pry bars and scrapers and different things. I have one that it's a common screwdriver that will even fit Phillips head screws. It's so messed up on the end. You know those tools I'm talking about? I have favorite tools that I like to use, and my boys know that there are certain ones that they're not to touch. And it frustrates me greatly when I want a certain tool and I can't find it. Somebody's had it, you know. I found my side cutters the other day in the medicine cabinet in the bathroom. I don't know how these guys, you know, what they're doing. You know what I'm talking about. You have special tools that you like to use, and you ladies are the same way in the kitchen. You've got one little knife in there that you like to use. I remember my grandmother had a knife that the blade was so thin back down next to the hammer, to the handle. Have you ever seen one like that? I mean, boy, you can just wrap the thing right around a potato, and that's how it got that way. That's my grandmother must have peeled thousands of potatoes with that thing. And it was so thin down there. And some of you have one like that. You'll buy a new one, but you'd still rather have that one. Oh, it just fits. Did you know God is the same way? He has some favorite tools. You know why? Because he can always count on them. He can always count on them. It's not just a man with a plan. It's a man with power, a man who is in a right relationship with God. And I have often wondered, and you have too, why some people are very successful at soul winning and other people just seem never to influence anybody for the Lord. Why is that? How is it that some people always seem to find the prepared hearts? Don't you suppose it's because God knows who he can count on to be faithful to deal with that person in the right way at the right time? I believe it is, you see. God knows if we're going to be faithful or not to witness to people and how we're going to do that. And I believe the Lord sends prepared hearts along the way of people that he loves to use. God has some favorite tools. Wouldn't you love to be one of God's favorite tools? Wouldn't you like to be an old familiar carving knife to just cut away the dross and the sin in people's lives and show them the gospel? Sure. Listen, that's what God wants us to be. Well, how do you have that power? Spurgeon says you have to have two things. I think he's right. First thing you have to have is a high degree of spirituality. A high degree of spirituality. That means a person who's sober-minded, a person who's heavenly-minded, not so heavenly-minded that he's no earthly good, but I'm not so sure that really you can be that way, you see. I think what we're talking about there is people who have false piety. And false piety does nobody any good. That's not a high degree of spirituality. That's a high degree of dramatics is what that is. We're talking about a fellow that walks close with the Lord, a lady that just walks close with Jesus, somebody who's in touch with God and who loves the Lord and sees God involved in things. And then the other aspect of that person's character is humility, a humble person. You know, if a person has genuine humility, they'll really be able to influence people for the Lord. Don't you appreciate humble people? Don't you get frustrated with proud people? You think about it for a few minutes. You know what one of the greatest problems of poor people that need help today is? Pride. Pride. You think about it for a few minutes. In our Five Loaves ministry, when people come in to get help, sometimes they're too proud to ask for help. And we'll counsel them and try to help them see the root of their problem and the reason that they're having to ask for charity. And sometimes folks say, well, I'm not asking for charity. Well, what are you asking for? You see? Charity is what we need. A humble person is humble because he knows that he needs charity. He needs grace from God, you see? We need to think about that. All of us have to have grace from God. If it weren't for the grace of God, we'd be in terrible shape. And so a humble person, someone who's not proud, not puffed up with his own appreciation or appreciating himself and so on. You see, where there's pride, there's going to be contention. Have you ever gotten into a spat with somebody when you're out soul winning? Ever got into a disagreement with them? I mean, you got offended? There's no way that a humble person can get offended. Great peace have they which love thy law, and nothing shall offend them. Did you ever get offended by somebody you were witnessing to? That ought to be a good indicator to you that you're witnessing in the flesh. A person, not just a man or a person with a plan, but a person with power, being one of God's special tools. Now, another thing, it's not just a person with a Bible either, but it's a person with a living faith in his Bible. Now, that makes a big difference. You see, I carry a New Testament with me all the time, and then I sometimes even take a Bible with me on visitation or when I go to see somebody. I mean, a whole Bible. But it's not just a person with the Bible. You can carry a Bible with you and never be a soul winner. You can even show Bible passages to people and not really be a soul winner. A soul winner is a person with a living faith in his Bible. Now, what does that mean? That means a person that genuinely believes that the Bible is the Word of God. He genuinely believes it. Not only that, he genuinely believes that he is the messenger from God for that person. Don't you suppose it would give you more confidence when you went soul winning if you believed, knew for sure, that the only way that that person that you were witnessing to could ever have faith in his heart was for him to hear the Word of God, and the only way for him to hear the Word of God was for you to give it to him? Now, isn't that what Romans 10 teaches? I think everybody ought to read Romans 10 before they go soul winning. Just how shall they hear without a preacher? How shall they preach except they be sent? You see? So, a faith also that is seen in earnestness. Earnestness. A person who presents the Bible with earnestness. Now, you know, I have to be real careful sometimes because I get so earnest about things, I sound angry when I hear myself later. You know, sometimes I listen to myself on tape, and I was being real earnest, but when I listen to myself, I sound mad. You know, a dear friend of mine who's used to be one of our deacons told me one time, he said, you know, this was in a deacon's meeting. He says, you know, I sound real mad. I said, well, I'm not mad. Well, and then he very wisely said, well, you know, my wife told me one time that I sounded mad, and I wasn't mad either. But then I realized if I sound mad, I might as well be as far as the other person's concerned. And I thought, boy, that's a big responsibility. If I'm giving that other person the impression that I'm mad, then might as well be mad. So we're not talking about earnestness that comes across with vehemence and this sort of thing. I mean, sometimes I believe things so strongly that sometimes when I'm telling somebody about something that I believe, it sounds almost like that I'm angry at them. You need to be very, very careful about that. As this is especially true with my family. Sometimes I'll just be preaching there at the table, you know, and I'll just be coming down on things, you know. And then I'll look at them and I see they're thinking, is he mad? And then I'll have to say, no, you know, I'm not mad. but we don't need to give people that impression anyway. Be earnest, but don't sound angry. Okay? Now, it's not a person with a plan, it's a person with power. It's not a person just with a Bible, but a person with a living faith in his Bible. And then finally, it's not a showman, it's a man of simplicity. A soul winner is a person of simplicity. Simplicity in the Bible does not refer to having few things about you. It refers to having one thing on your mind. You see, a simple-minded person in the Bible is a good thing. He only has one thing, singleness of purpose, pure in heart. It means he's committed to one thing. This person has single-mindedness, no hidden motives. He's not a glory hound. He doesn't have the desire to brag or to promote other people. I mean, he's the kind of a fellow who won a soul to Christ, and it doesn't really matter to him whether anybody knows who won that fellow to Christ. You see? And honestly, we get so caught up in the number of people saved and the number of baptisms per church per year and this kind of thing. And I have a real hard time sometimes getting motivated by soul-winning programs that evaluate or have contests on the basis of the number of souls that a person has won to Christ in a given period of time. I was at a place one time where people were being honored for the number of souls that they had won. And there was one lady there that received the award for having won the week before 380 souls in 1 week in personal soul winning. Now you figure it out. How many hours there are in a day, how many hours a person could reasonably be expected to stay awake each day for 7 days, and see how much time that gives you. There's not enough time to deal with people adequately. I mean, even if people wanted to get saved, I don't think you could lead them through a prayer effectively like that. Now, if you can lead 380 souls to the Lord in a week, well, do it, okay? Do it. But honestly, when I see that kind of thing, I don't get a great blessing out of it. I become very skeptical, and then I start feeling guilty about my attitude. You see, that's what bothers me about that kind of thing. So I don't know that really, really honors the Lord a great deal. It's not a showman. It's a person of simplicity, somebody who's not looking for honors, but somebody who's wanting to help people stay out of hell. It's a man who's completely surrendered to God, in other words. A person whose heart is totally given to the Lord. Spurgeon says, a man whose heart throbs as the strings of a harp in the hand of God. That's good, isn't it? In other words, a person that's just so filled with the love of the Lord that he just cares about people. Was it James Gray, that famous preacher at the turn of the century, was he the pastor of the Moody Church around 1900, who walked down the street of Chicago one day? I think I shared this story with you. And he walked up to a man and asked him, maybe it was Tory, I can't remember, but he walked up to the man and asked him if he was saved. And the man says, I don't suppose that's any of your business. And with tears in his eyes, this pastor said, oh, but sir, that's my whole business. And he led the man to Christ right there on the street. In other words, he was a man of God, and he had the power of God in his life. Did I share with you? I think it was last Thursday night when I was talking to the soul winners. Let me share it with you. A story that John R. Rice told. And shared in his book on soul winning, how that he was convicted for soul winning under the ministry of Gypsy Smith. And he determined that he was going to be a soul winner. He made up his mind in that meeting that night that he was going to witness faithfully to people. And so the meeting was over, the invitation was finished, and the after service was beginning with a few hymns and announcements and things like that. And they were concluding, and Dr. Gray, of course, or Dr. Gypsy Smith had already left. So Dr. Rice was there just as a young man, and he made up his mind he was going to witness to the first person that he met when he left the meeting. And so he went outside, and there was a taxi there, And he hailed the taxi, and he got in the taxi, and he was impressed to witness to the man, and he said, "Sir, are you a Christian?" And the taxi driver said, "As a matter of fact, I am." He said, "Well, how long have you been saved?" He said, "Well, I just got saved a moment ago. It was a gray-haired man came out of that door and led me to Christ." It was Gypsy Smith. Isn't that a precious story? And it's true. But and he was so impressed with the fact that here was a man that really meant business for the Lord. And he determined in his heart that he was going to do that same thing. You know, I had occasion to meet him. And I'll tell you, one thing you have to realize about old Dr. Rice was he was concerned about people's souls. And I had the occasion when I was taking the teens up to the Bill Rice Ranch in 1978, I guess it was, up there, maybe 79, that summer. And went downtown and went to the Store of the Lord building there. And Dr. Rice was in. And I was with a missionary, and we went up to meet him. And the missionary's son was with us. And so we went up there, and we met him, and he was going to show us his library. And while we were in looking at these hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of books that he had back in there, he went up to this little boy, and he sat down, and he brought that little fellow and put him up on his knee, and he said, "Son, are you saved?" Like that. I thought, bless your heart. What an impact that made on me. I'll never forget that. But that's the kind of compassion, the kind of concern that we ought to have. A soul winner is a person that is genuinely concerned about people's souls. Not just a person or a man with a Bible, but a man with a living faith in his Bible. Not just a showman, but a man of simplicity. Now, that's what a soul winner is toward God. Let's think very quickly now. What is a soul winner towards man? Well, first thing a soul winner is towards man, again, what he is not, these are Spurgeon's words, he is not an ignoramus. He is not a fella who knows nothing about what he's saying. Not a fella who has some simple answers for simple people, but a fella who really understands what he believes. Did you know that you will be used of God to touch those who are like you to a very large degree? Now let me show you something. There are two groups of people, if you can't imagine in your mind. Let me go this way for your sake. Here is one level, okay? Now you can reach people in a socioeconomic and intellectual level that are above you and below you and then right about where you are. In other words, you probably don't have much opportunity to mix and mingle and have contact with people that are greatly removed from your station in life. I don't mean to put people in classes, but it's true. The people that you work with, your neighbors, these kinds of things, you will probably come into contact with people that are somewhat above you and somewhat below you. Do you know what the trend is in evangelism? Honestly now. It's to always reach the lower group. Always. You know why? Because it's easier. It's less threatening. And then you win these people on the next lower level, and then they win the people on the next lower level, and they win the people on the next lower level. That's why always in a soul-winning church, there will be an awful lot of uneducated people that really love the Lord. And a lot of people have been critical about soul-winning churches for that reason. They say, well, you know, when you get all this big hype about soul-winning, well, you know, you bring in all the rabble. And I've heard all of those arguments. It's not because of that. Listen, the same thing happened when Jesus was on earth, when people started reaching each other. But, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. Did you know you can reach the fellow who's above you, too, in socioeconomic levels? Don't you suppose there are some bankers that probably would want to listen to the gospel if somebody would speak to them without causing them to feel that they were, you know, being insulted? You see, I'm not saying that we ought to kowtow to these people or that we ought to embarrass ourselves or degrade the gospel for their benefit. But I've talked with some people. I'm not saying that you ought to go for the rich people either. I've met a fellow one time who felt like his whole ministry was to rich people. I'm not real interested in specialist evangelism anyway. I think it's house to house and door to door and person to person. And I don't think you ought to, you know, pick out which ones you're going to witness to. But sometimes I think we're afraid to witness to people that are more educated than we are, or that have more money than we have, or that drive a nicer car than we do. And somehow the devil convinces us that because these people have more of the world's goods, they're not going to want to listen to us. Let me tell you something. Honestly, I was an extremely proud person when I was lost. And I've struggled with pride all of my life, as many people have. I was the kind of a person that even now I don't like to witness to, because I was a smart aleck. and I had a sarcastic remark for everything that was said to me. And I enjoyed getting the best of people and having fun at their expense and then acting like I was just kidding them. You see, when I was a boy, I got put down an awful lot. And so when I got older and got a little wittier, I enjoyed putting other people down. You know who won me to Christ? I've told you before. A fellow was in the service. He had left his job moving furniture for the Wicks Corporation in Saginaw, Michigan. He got out of the service. He went right back. And to this day, he delivers furniture for the Wicks Corporation. I thank God he witnessed to me. He writes me several times each year, misspells all kinds of words. Boy, I love that guy. I write to him every summer that we possibly can. We coordinate our vacations to get together with him. I don't care whether he can spell or not. You see? I love the guy. You see? Because he led me to Christ. He loved me enough to forget about the fact that I was going to put him down if he didn't pronounce a word right. And I did that stuff. And I've teased him some about it since. And he always comes back with something that gets me. About, you know, you're always real good at that. And then he starts talking to me about my responsibility. You know? And just shuts me right down. You know? And you know, I'd start teasing him about something. And he'd say, you know, God's really going to use you to reach so many more people. And I'd say, oh, brother. Leave this guy alone. But you see what I'm saying? Listen. Thank God that he had enough concern and compassion to witness to me. And that, you know, don't let somebody scare you away because he's got a PhD or because he's, you know, a banker or a lawyer or whatever he is. Don't be afraid of that kind of thing. He's a human being. Respect his position. You're not going to win somebody by insulting the years of their lives that they've put into getting that position in life. So honor that and respect it, but at the same time, you've got the truth, you see? And the truth is true, whether you've got it or he's got it. It's true, you see? And so share the truth with him. So a soul winner is not an ignoramus. It's a fellow who knows the Bible and who witnesses somebody else that needs the truth. But remember that he's going to be of use generally to those people that are like himself, okay? He's a man of sincerity and good nature, a good-natured person. If a person's going to be a successful soul winner, he's got to be a good-natured person. You know, a person who's right with God ought not to be a cantankerous old crank. Really, I've seen some Christians, as one preacher said, some Christians who wear their Christianity like a bad headache. You think about it. They go around with a painful look on their face. Like, if they were to tell somebody else, you know, if you trust Christ as your Savior, you can be like me. Thanks anyway. No thanks. I don't need any more problems. You see? But I'm telling you, some people, all they ever talk about is their problems. And their suffering and, oh, whoa. You know? You think about it for a few minutes. Some people, when you see them coming, you know, or something. I mean, you just want to avoid them. All they have is some negative complaint about a thing. But a person, listen, what does it mean to be a good-natured person? Well, first off, it means a person with sincerity. You know, look, if I had a cannonball right here, and if I was going to go hunting, you could give me the biggest cannonball in the world and let me throw it at the deer. I wouldn't want that. But you give me a little bullet and let me shoot it out of a rifle. You see, sincerity is force. Sincerity has more force than the forcefulness of any strong personality. Sincerity really makes an impact on people. And a person who really means business, I mean, who really believes what he believes, and who is a good-natured, sincere person, is always more effective than a big person. You know what I mean? Force, not bigness. That's the key. Bullet, not a cannonball. And the way you get that is with sincerity, not with flamboyance. Remember that. And then another good nature aspect of a person's good nature is evident unselfishness and seriousness of manner. Seriousness of manner. Sometimes I think I joke around too much. I know I do with some of you. Some of you, I want to be close to you, and you know, you share your latest joke with me, and I share my latest joke with you, and that sort of thing. And then I think sometimes maybe when you got a serious problem, you're afraid I'm going to joke. I had that happen to me one time. A man that I dearly loved, and I really had something serious on my heart. And I'd always kidded around with him and joked around with him. And when I came up to see him, I started trying to be serious with him. And he started joking with me and kidding around. And I didn't want to kid. I was hurting. But then I was even hurt more, you see. And I think sometimes we kid a little too much. I think I do, probably, and I probably have with some of you. And that grieves me when I think about it. And I hope that you know that I take this seriously. I take your needs seriously. And if you've got something bothering you, let me know about it. And sometimes even, if we are joking around or something, and something's troubling your soul or something there, if I am joking with you, I'm not doing it because I have a lightness of heart. It's because I want to lighten your load a little bit. I mean, sometimes telling somebody a funny joke is the best way I know of to just get a man to be able to shoulder his burden a little bit better for the next day. I love to see people laugh. And the reason I tell jokes to people is not because I'm not serious, but it's because I'm trying to lighten your burden. Sometimes it looks like you got the weight of the world on your shoulders. Tell you a joke and see you laugh a little bit, and maybe you're ready to go on. Take it again, you see. But sometimes I know that that's not what we need to do. If we don't need a joke, maybe I need to get under and shoulder it with you. And I want to do that. But a person who's serious-minded, serious in his manner, and who has evident unselfishness, that's what it means to be good-natured. And then I think, and this is something that's so important, somebody with an abundance of tenderness. An abundance of tenderness. Now, you think of me as a tender person, some of you. Others of you may not think of me as a tender person. It depends on what context you see me. I'm sure that many of my family members don't think of me as tender, because they see me when I'm looking for my newspaper after they've put it somewhere where I can't find it, or lost some other possession of mine when we're on our way to church. And I've talked to you about a number of those things. I've got the comb problem solved, I think. I put the fear of destruction in a few people. But you see, but at any rate, you got to be tender. And I want to be tender. Sometimes I think I'm too tender when I ought to spank my kids. You know, they break my heart and they come in there and they got their little sob story going on. One of them gets up in the night and crawls in the bed with us. And, you know, I ought to take them back there and put them in their own bed. And I think, oh, bless his heart, you know, maybe he's scared or whatever, you know, that kind of thing. You feel that way? I think I'd probably rather go too much in that direction. We need to be that way with older people, too. We need to be that way with adults. Tender. You know, I haven't always been that way. I mean, I guess I've always had a soft spot in my heart, maybe one in my head, but I haven't always been real tender with people. I used to be very selfish with people. And the Lord has been giving me, as I get closer to Him, a desire to be tender with people. You know, one of the main things that will help you to reach somebody that's hurting and is sin is tenderness. And I think the place where we fail more than anything else is in being tender with somebody we're trying to win to Christ. I mean, look, when you go to see the doctor and you're hurting and he says, does that hurt? Of course it hurts. Don't do that. You see, he's trying to find out where you're hurting. Now, if he kept poking you there and kept poking you, after a while you'd say, look, I told you it hurts. Now cut it out. You see? Now, if you're talking to him about his sin, yes, that hurts. It's embarrassing for a person to admit that. It hurts a person to say, yes, he's a sinner. Yes, he deserves to go to hell. That is not an easy thing for us to admit, let alone for a person that's on his way there to admit. That's hard to say. And sometimes I think people would share their burdens with us if they thought we weren't going to hurt them. I remember one time Brother Wayne and I went to some kind of a seminar or something in Indianapolis. And we were up there, and we met a young man, and it was so funny. All the other fellows had on sports shirts, you know, and we had... You know, we're Bob Jones grads. We had on neckties. You know what I mean? We had on short sleeve white shirts and neckties. And this guy across the table, you know, was teasing us about looking like Mormons. And so he said, where are you guys from? We said, we're from Greenville. And where'd you go to school? Went to Bob Jones. You went to Bob Jones? We'd eaten with this guy several times before he asked us. He says, I'd have never figured you guys went to Bob Jones. And I said, how come? And these were his words. He said, I always thought Bob Jones guys were Band-Aid rippers. I had never heard that expression in my life. And I said, what do you mean by that? He said, well, you know, somebody's got a sore place and a BJ guy comes along and rips his Band-Aid off and says, hey, you got a sore place. He said, that's the way I thought these guys were. He said, but you guys aren't like that. He said, you know, there's a whole lot of other people down there that are not like that too. But I got to thinking about that. And I thought, boy, I wonder if I've ever been a Band-Aid ripper with somebody. You know, just go rip somebody's bandage off and tell him he's got a sore place. That doesn't help anybody. Tenderness. You got to be tender with people. Love people. Learn to speak in soothing tones to people that are hurting in sin. Now, I believe you ought to cry aloud, and I believe you ought to prophesy against wickedness and things like that. But at the same token, you do not use the same tone of voice and the same methodology when you're street preaching and when you're witnessing to some guy in his living room. You see? Those are different places and different circumstances. When I preach on the radio, I do not preach on the radio much like I preach here. We had a brilliant idea here a while back how we were going to take the Sunday messages and put them on the daily radio broadcast. But the more we got to thinking about it, we thought it'll never work. Never work. I holler too much when I'm preaching here on Sundays. And when you're listening to somebody on your way to work, you don't want some guy hollering at you when you're out in traffic, do you? You want some fella who's just going to have a chat with you, one-on-one. If I was sitting in your car talking to you like that, you'd probably ask me to get out. You see? See, there's a different place and a different method. And when you're soul winning, when you're witnessing one-on-one to another person, you need to have a little respect for that person and realize that, you know, when you're that close to a person, you can't. I can speak to you differently when you're 50 feet away from me than I can when you're 5 feet away from me. You see? Keep those things in mind and use good sense and be tender. We'll talk about some more of these things, about what you can do to be a soul winner and what soul winning really is. But keep those things in mind. It's not just a man with a plan who's talking to other people about his 4 or 5 points. It's somebody who really has power with God. And then it's not just somebody who has a Bible, but it's somebody who has a living faith in his Bible. It's not a showman. It's a man of simplicity. A man who has one thing in mind, that's bringing honor and glory to the Lord. Serious-mindedness, surrender to God, tender heart, all those things that characterize real spirituality. Keep those things in mind. If a person will develop those characteristics and manifest those traits, he can begin to be tremendously effective for the Lord. Let's pray.